Welcome to Chapter 7, Stock Price Behavior and Market Efficiency. Well, a better name for this chapter might be, Can You Beat the Market? And the answer is maybe, or maybe not. And there is quite a bit of buzz and brouhaha and discussion in the industry now about beating the market. The conventional wisdom, which is wrong, as we'll see in this chapter, is that nobody can beat the market. But it turns out in the long run, it doesn't matter. As long as you're persistent and prudent and do well, maybe you'll beat the market, maybe not, but even still, you'll do pretty darn well, assuming the world doesn't end. Unless you get involved in the latest mania and then pull out in the crash, which is what a lot of people wind up doing. And one of them was Sir Isaac Newton. Yes, you know, the apple, gravity, that guy. He said it best, I can calculate the movement of the stars, but not the madness of men. And he was one of them that got burnt by the extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds that happened many years ago. It's nothing new, folks. Market manias and crashes and bubbles are nothing new, and they will always be with us, as we shall see. So let's get started. Yeah, he got burnt too. So if you get burnt, remember that Sir Isaac Newton, you know, one of the greatest minds of the humankind, he also got burnt by a stock bubble. Slide number two. The random walk and efficient market hypotheses. In the late 1960s, early 1970s, some academics and some people in the industry started saying, well, wait a minute, are we really doing any good? Are we really, as money managers, mutual funds and the like, actually adding any value? And they hypothesized that stock price movements were completely random. But the truth of the matter is they are in the short term. In the long term, no, they are not. In fact, we hope that they're not, because that means the economy, the global economy now, will have failed. But this research showed that in the short term, you're better off just throwing darts at a dartboard. And because you can't, nobody has been able to accurately predict. There's lots of people who can not accurately, incorrectly predict where stock price movement, the market as a whole, and stock prices, individual stock prices can go. They can incorrectly do it, and some of them get paid a lot of money, and you might become one of them if you learn how to do this stuff in the next chapter well, and we'll see that in a bit. But as we said, in the long term, no. Think of the yo-yo up as you walk up a stairs. You know, the market's bouncing up and down, but the global economy is expanding, and people are doing better. The efficient market theorists said that in a market in which securities reflect all possible information quickly and accurately, then in sufficiently large numbers of knowledgeable investors will react quickly to new information, and security prices will adjust quickly and accurately. So the efficient market theorists say, look, as long as the market is an efficient market, there are sufficient buyers and sufficient sellers, such as the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, the Frankfurt, the German Exchange, the Japanese, you know, as long as there's enough buyers and sellers, then the information that is divulged as time goes on will accurately and quickly be adjusted in all prices. Much of this is discussed in that book we talked about, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, because Professor Malkiel was one of those academics. And he has such a great time. He skewers the fundamental analysts. He skewers the technical analysts, which we'll do in the next chapter. And he skewers the random walk theory folks, too. So he takes no prisoners. Good man. Slide number 3. In the 1970s, when this research was being codified, there was also plenty of stuff going on in the world of physics, and they had these weak forces and strong forces and semi-strong forces. So the folks in this world started using those terms, the weak efficiency hypothesis. And the weak efficiency hypothesis says that past data on stock prices are of no use in predicting future prices. Well, we find this to be true by doing statistical analyses and showing that, sure, you know, the previous 3 months is not indicative of the past 3 months, but stock prices do tend to demonstrate momentum. And you'll hear the technical analysts say the trend is your friend. Stock prices tend to rise more often than they fall, but we know that because the global economy is expanding, and they tend to move far higher than is usually justified, sometimes called a mania, a bubble, or far lower than is usually warranted, a crash. And why is that? Because we're human. It's that simple. Fear and greed. Fear and greed. John Maynard Keynes, Sir John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist who is credited with helping the developed world get out of the Great Recession, was once asked by some speculators, some traders, some market savvy people, how could the market stay irrational this long? They were opining, they were complaining that the market was way overvalued and they were shorting stocks trying to get the market to go down. And of course the problem with that is that you can lose a lot of money quickly. It's like jumping in front of a freight train. And his response was now famous. The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. So he said, sure, you're right. There are times when the market's overpriced. There are times when the market is underpriced. But you don't know how long it's going to last. Just because you can be absolutely sure that it's overpriced doesn't mean it's going to happen in the next few months or next few years. It could take several years. And if this theory is true, which I have a tendency to agree with it, then technical analysis, which we will cover in the next chapter, is basically useless. And I agree, because the statistics show us that in the short term, 3 months, 6 months, nobody's been able to do it. And if they were, they certainly aren't going to tell anybody, but they would quickly be found out, folks. It would, unless they're really good at hiding their gains. Slide number 4, the semi-strong efficiency hypothesis. Abnormally large profits cannot be consistently earned using publicly available information. In other words, no amount of analysis that you do to determine the future price of a stock will help you beat the market. The problem with this hypothesis is that there are many, many investors who have beaten the market over long periods of time, and we will look at some of them later. So what does the theory say about those investors? That's the problem, isn't it? This theory is saying that investors cannot beat the market over the long term, and yet there are many who do. So the theory says, well, those people are just lucky. Well, it reminds me of a very famous quote, and it's attributed to many different people, so we don't really know who actually said it. But it was a golfer or a tennis or somebody in sports who had done very well. And the reporter said, boy, you are really lucky out there today. And he said, you know, you're absolutely right. And the funny thing is, the more I practice, the luckier I get. Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Some people are just very good at what they do. And when there's tremendous competition, because there are tremendous rewards, the creme de la creme rise to the top. If this theory is true, and I don't think it is, then fundamental analysis, which we did in chapters 6 and 7, that was fundamental analysis, folks, is basically useless. And I don't agree. as we'll see, we're going to see some investors who have done very well, and they're more than just lucky. Slide number 5, the strong efficiency hypothesis. No information, public or private, allows investors to earn abnormally large profits consistently. Uh-huh. One insider information trade can make you rich overnight. If you don't get caught, that is. This is obviously false. If you had material, non-public information, that's the legal term for insider information, about a company, if you had that information, knowing tomorrow their drug was going to be denied by the FDA or approved by the FDA, you can make a fortune overnight. We'll learn how when we get through options. But you can also go to jail. And you should, because this is stealing. Huh? Just because you got information that other people don't have, that's stealing? It is. Or at least that's what the law says. Some people say it shouldn't be made illegal. But if you have material non-public information, that's the legal term, we call it insider information. If you have that information and you trade on it, or you tell somebody else to trade on it and they trade on it, then you could go to jail. And you should. And you probably heard of Martha Stewart. I didn't even knew what she looked like until this thing happened, and I thought, okay, I got to learn about her. But I don't like celebrities. I don't like the cult of whatever you call it, Kardashians and Brittany Lopez and Jennifer Spears. I mean, it just it nauseates me. But there are people who like that. And I am certain that her publicists, Martha Stewart's publicist, told her, go ahead, lie. Tell them that you actually didn't do this, and you'll do about 4 or 5 months in jail, and you will get so much publicity out of that. They'll have you, you know, show you on TV, showing the convicts how to make a turkey or whatever. What did she do? Well, she was the ex-girlfriend of her ex-boyfriend, who was the president of a drug company, and he did it too. He sold his shares before the, and he knew the FDA was going to deny their drug. He sold his shares before it became public, which he's not allowed to do. And she sold her shares. And they had a common stockbroker who told her, you know, you better sell your shares. And then the SEC was all over them because they have these computer programs that try to sniff out this kind of stuff. And they caught the both of them. And the stockbroker turned state's evidence. I think that's what it's called when he snitched, right? And so she was caught dead to the wind. They got her with their hands in the cookie jar, and yet she still denied it. And I think it was on purpose so she could go to jail and get all that publicity. Because once she left, exactly. So you understand? If you have insider information, you can't trade. You can't let anybody else know. Or if you let somebody else know and they trade, both of you are in trouble. Don't do it. Slide number 6. Market efficiency rationale. The random walk and efficient market theorists are often also major proponents of index funds. They point to the fact that many professional money managers simply do not beat the market, especially during bull markets. From 1963 to 1998, the S&P 500 index, very popular index as we saw, outperformed general equity mutual funds 22 out of 36 times. They reason that you are better off accepting close to the market's return with low-cost index funds, since their theory tells them that no one can consistently beat the market. Now, you have to be careful. There are so many mutual funds now, and many of them are benchmarked against the Standard & Poor's 500. But a lot of them, they're not the same index. The S&P 500, as we said, has lost some of its focus. Many mutual funds now have a more global bent. So you have to look at more global indexes. But the global indexes aren't that good either. So it's not as cut and dried as the market efficiency adherents say. But still, how come? Yeah, how come, right? Slide number 7. Why can't many pros beat the averages? Well, mutual funds, many mutual funds have high operating expenses and high turnover rates. So there you are right there. You have to, if you have a 2% a year annual fee, you've got to beat the market by at least 2% just to break even. And many mutual fund managements have a very short time horizon. If you don't do well in 2 years, kid, you're out. So many mutual fund managers have a very short lifespan. They roll the dice, they take large bets, figuring if they do well, great, they get to stay and get showered with love and attention and a whole lot of money. And if they don't do well, well, they were going to get kicked out anyway. Now, most mutual funds now are realizing that that's not the best way to run a company. This was, you know, Fidelity for many decades. That it was the guy who, you know, made Fidelity what it was, even admitted so much in that book I talked about, Wall Street People. But the premises and the casual observations of the efficient market theorists show them to be patently absurd. Because there are many mutual fund managers and many other managers that have beaten the market over long, statistically significant periods of time. The more I practice, the better I get. Plus, if markets are efficient and rational, how do you explain manias, bubbles, slide 8? Occasionally, investors get caught up in what are called manias and bubbles, right? The internet bubble is not even in some of you, your remembrance, because some of you were very young at the time, but it's in a very it's clear in people's, in many people's minds who got involved in the stock market, because the internet was brand new and you could trade online and everybody was doing it and day trading. Well, that was the latest stock mania. Before that, there was the Nifty 50 of the early 1970s. You've heard of the Nifty 50, like CalComp and Tektronix and Metromedia and Polaroid? Well, you've heard the name, and the name will live forever. The company went bankrupt almost 20 years ago. But Polaroid was a company that made a camera. You can look it up, you young folks. You might be interested in this. That actually would develop the film right away within 60 seconds. And the stock exploded and then imploded. And everyone thought you couldn't lose money with Polaroid. I don't know about you folks, but I would not want to invest in a company that the name rhymed with hemorrhoid. I just wouldn't want to do it. But that name will live on forever. People love that name. The name Kodak will live on forever, too. Who was another Nifty 50? Avon, which has never recovered from there. The mania of the 1920s resulted in the crash of 29 and the subsequent depression. And it wasn't really the crash that led to the depression. There were some other factors involved that the Federal Reserve, which was relatively new, the Federal Reserve Bank made some boneheaded maneuvers. And in the crash of 2008, the Federal Reserve Bank, under the direction of Ben Bernanke, swore they weren't going to make those same mistakes. Now other people would say that they made other mistakes that are going to make it even worse, and we'll see. In the 1929, what were the internet stocks then? Automobiles and radio. Radio Corporation of America. You know it as RCA. And RCA sold for what? $290 at the peak? 3 or 4 years later, it was selling for $2. In the 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms, because that was the new technology of the time, and certainly railroads changed the world, and now there are 4 railroad firms. But the granddaddy of all manias, dear students, the granddaddy of all manias was the Dutch tulip bulb craze of the early 1600s. Yes, you read and heard correctly, tulip bulbs, which I think came from Turkey, were introduced to the Netherlands, and became an instant mania. Tulip bulbs were bought and sold like stocks, to the point where one tulip bulb would fetch what today would be worth $1.5 million. Fortunes were made and then subsequently lost when you guessed it. I mean, think about it, folks. Tulip bulbs. You put a tulip bulb in the ground. What does it do? It does what most living things try to do, or all living things try to do. It makes more tulip bulbs. And so eventually that mania fell apart, as all manias, all bubbles. We always know what comes next. And by the way, dear students, was the crash of 2008 and 2009 created by the mania in stocks in the 2000s? No. It was the real estate bubble. It was the real estate mania, and specifically the bonds that were tied to those mortgages. And we'll learn more about mortgage-backed securities, mortgage-backed bonds when we get to bonds. That's what killed the stock market. Don't blame the stock market for 2008 and 2009. Stocks were not that. Oh, they were richly valued in 2007, but they were not anywhere near like as they were in 1999, 2000. There's a wonderful book, dear students, you really should read it. Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. It was written in the 1840s, and it still is a shocker. It talks about the insanity of witchcraft and the Crusades, along with the financial picadillos of the ages, one of which got Sir Isaac Newton involved. And another book that discusses this is The Botany of Desire. Oh, lots of fun. He talks about our relationship with plants and how we think we control the plants, but it turns out they control us. They get us to feed them and water them and get rid of the bugs, and they're very smart, those plants. Each time the phrase was, it's a new era, it's different this time. The old ways of valuing stock are gone, and each time they are wrong. So much for rational, efficient markets. Slide number 9. Why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lesson? Any ideas? Well, here's a great quote from Leonard Kaplan, president of commodities brokerage firm Prospector Asset Management in Evanston, Illinois. Market manias will happen over and over again because the public is infinitely stupid. Is he right? Yeah, well, Benjamin Graham says the speculative public is incorrigible. He's noticed the speculative public. You know, he's making a distinction between speculators and traders and investors. The speculative public is incorrigible. It will buy anything at any price if there seems to be some action in progress. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, or what have you. When the particular fashion is raging, the abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. And he wrote this in 1972, when computers, electronics, and science and technology were still very, very new. Franchising was all the buzz. But if you replace franchising and computers with internet and biotechnology, then old Ben could have been written in could have been writing in 2000 instead of 1972. But today the buzzwords are social networking, wearables, and marijuana. It'll never end, folks. There will always be manias. Slide number 11. And how do manias end? Right. They end invariably with a crash. I like this phrase. The bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. They are not fun, folks. But the odds are you will live through at least one during your investing career. And while you're in the middle of it, it will not be that easy to determine when it's going to end. Or if it's going to. It'll start to feel like it's never going to end. That's when you really should be worried, right? That's when you really should be worried. And here was a guy who in August 1999, at the height of the bubble, companies were coming out and becoming instant large cap companies. People were becoming multimillionaires, billionaires, every few days. Here's what he had to say. With this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. Now, this guy had been in the industry for 49 years when he said this. He retired the next year. Was he a genius or what? Exactly. He knew it's coming, and you know what? I'm getting out of the biz. And he died just sadly just a couple of years ago. There's a on my website in chapter 4 is a link to his obituary from a gentleman who knew him well, Tom Petruno of the LA Times. He's a very amazing guy, John Lovelace, so check out his career. Oh, by the way, as I said, the 2008-2009 market crash was not caused by the stock market bubble. It was the real estate bubble and the mortgage-backed bonds that were tied to the real estate mortgages. So you're going to live through them, folks. You're going to live through manias and crashes. Manias, bubbles, and crashes. And some people say we're in a mania now. I don't believe it. I know some stocks are way overvalued. That's for sure. The most speculative of the stocks. The GoPros, the Titters. I'm sorry, Twitter, the farce. Facebooks of the world. And, you know, some of them might survive and some of them we know are going to crash. But as a whole, the market is richly valued, in my humble opinion, but not way overvalued. And I knew in 2008 and 2009 that we were coming back, didn't I? Come on, convince yourself that you did. No, I didn't think it was going to happen as fast as it did. I thought it was going to take 10 years as opposed to 5 or 6. But we've made it back, and now we're on the next leg up. When it'll end, I don't know, but it's going to end someday. We're going to have a bear market again. We know that's going to happen. Will it be a crash this time of 40-50%? I don't think so, but doesn't mean I'm right. Slide number 12. Here are the 11 worst days of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And this is very interesting, folks. Very interesting. If you look at the 11 days, six of them are in October. One is in early November. What's going on here? Well, there are many theories for why the fall is the worst time for crashes. And none of them are very good, in my humble opinion, except for one. And that is the fact that we are still animals. As much as we like to think of ourselves as above the animal world, 100,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, even 1,000 years ago, when fall came around, exactly what was going to happen? Yeah, winter's coming, and the days grow shorter, and the crops die, and the trees lose their leaves. It's the fall. And we look around and we know that some of us ain't going to make it through the winter. There is a very good reason why All Hallows Eve, Halloween, All Souls Day, All Saints Day, Dia de los Muertos, why those days, October 31st, November 1st, November 2nd, why they are in the fall. Because we're animals and because that's the time we panic because death is at the door. And that's the time that the ancients figured this is a good time to venerate and remember those who have gone before us because we'll be following them soon enough. Now, that doesn't mean I'm right, folks, because there's no way to prove that theory. But that's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Slide number 13. Now, let's take a look at this slide. We saw this slide in Chapter 4, and you didn't understand it. But the current buzz about ETFs and index funds, it bothers me because it's overly simplistic. The financial websites and the talking heads and the people writing books and getting on the shows where they can be talking heads will tell you that don't try to beat the market. Just buy the market. Just buy the index fund and be happy with the market return. Remember to make sure it's a low-cost ETF or index fund. They're not trying to sneak in a high-cost one in your 401k. But the problem with that is the indexes can become skewed or bent out of shape, especially when a sector or a region of the economy becomes hot. And you saw this slide back in Chapter 4, but you didn't understand it, but now you will. You see, at the end of the 1980s, Japan's stock market, which was a part of the EFA, the Europe, Australia, and the Far East, was fully 60-some percent, not quite, 59.8%, almost 60% of the EFA. The companies in Japan made up 60% of the EFA, but with a PE of 51.9, almost 52. And what do we know with a PE of 52? If things don't go well, there's a whole lot of place to fall. There's a whole lot of room to fall. Exactly. The parachutes had better be very large because you got a long way to go down to 15 or 16. Everybody else, old Europe, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, Canada, that made up the IFA at that time, made up 40% of the index with a PE of 13, which is actually very reasonable, folks. And what happened over the next 10, 20 years? Japan's stock market dropped 80%, whereas the others, they didn't drop that much at all. I don't remember exactly what happened, but throughout the 2000s, actually, Europe did pretty darn well. Pretty well, as I remember. And Canada did well with the United States. So you see, you thought you were buying a broad-based index, but you were actually buying 60% Japan with a sky-high PE. And the same thing is true for the Standard & Poor's 500, the 500 largest companies traditionally based in the United States, in the year 2000, March of 2000, when the bubble hit its peak. You thought you were buying a broadly based index, and you were, but fully 33% of that broadly based index was information technology, including the internet stocks and the telecommunication stocks and the computer stocks, with a PE of almost 60, where everything else had a high PE of 19. I mean, 19 is pretty high, but not that high, and that was 66%, two-thirds of it. In other words, everything else in the United States, energy, healthcare, railroads, materials, housing, all the other parts of the economy and of the index was only two-thirds of the index. And, of course, what happened over the next 2.5 years is the NASDAQ, which did represent the technology component of the economy, fell 80%, whereas the S&P 500 fell almost 50% between March of 2000 and October of 2002. So you see, you thought that it was broadly based, but it wasn't. And so this is my argument with index funds. And the problem is the S&P 500 is just the United States. And we have to think globally. And the global indices aren't as good as the S&P 500 in that they don't represent the world as well as they should, in my humble opinion. It doesn't mean I'm right. So now do you understand my little beef with index funds? People get angry at me because they say I should in lockstep say that everyone should just buy index funds. And I don't agree. I do not agree. If there were no good mutual funds that had long records of beating the indices, I'd buy the index funds. But there are. They've shown that they can add value. That's the phrase they like to use in the industry. They've shown that they can protect you when things get like they are here on slide 13. And sure, they may lag at certain times in any one year. No one knows what's going to happen. But I want to see their long-term results. Slide number 14, I'm sorry. The argument for active management. And I know some people are going to say, you're just shilling for the mutual fund companies. Well, Vanguard still has active management. Ask them if they're going to get rid of PrimeCap. I hope they don't. PrimeCap's an awesome company. Today in the financial media, index funds and ETFs are touted as a better alternative to actively managed funds. As we saw, index funds do have the advantage of very low-cost investing. You know, make sure that yours do in your 401k if that's what you're going to use, or if you choose it on your own, you can make sure of that. But decades ago, Benjamin Graham warned against any investment strategy that relied on deterministic or robotic decision-making and removed the element of human judgment. Now, he was referring to some of these very high mathematical models. These models that use very sophisticated and high math, it's sometimes called, calculus and the like. But this is that's what an index fund is basically a robotic investment strategy. You look up the stocks that Standard & Poor's or Dow or whomever puts on their list of stocks and you buy it. I don't think that's a good way to invest. And here's a gentleman who agrees with me. And he uses the similar analogy. I like to think of sports figures and people in the arts and people in electronics and software and hardware, any devices. Here's what Mark Denning, who has 33 years of experience, says. As with any human endeavor, whether it is athletic competition, the performing arts, or technological innovation, some people clearly perform at a higher than average level. And he's absolutely right. I mean, I don't want to insult people who own Jeeps, but they're not very reliable, folks. How come Toyota and Honda, and now Mazda, and to some extent Hyundai, but not as quite as good, and Nissan, how come they always have cars that are more reliable? Now, every once in a while, there's a stinker, especially with Nissan and Hyundai. So if I stick to Toyota and Honda, I'll always be right. Because there's very few cars. Now, of course, Toyota had that acceleration problem. They didn't know what was going on. But in general, those companies always produce cars that are far more reliable. How come the Yankees are always in the playoffs and the World Series? And the Padres, exactly. You understand? There are just some entities that have performed at a higher level over long periods of time. What is it? I don't know. The culture, the reputation, the money, it's hard to know because every situation is very, very different. Can you hit a fastball at 95 miles an hour? Because if you can, you're going to make a lot of money. But don't even try it. I got into that batting cage at 60, and I was scared to death. Can you throw a fastball at 95 miles an hour? Can you hit a little bitty ball 345 yards down the fairway in three strokes into that little cup? Because if you can, you're going to make a whole lot of money. And if you can buy good stocks and avoid bad stocks, over the long term, you're going to do well. Now, whether you're not, you beat the market, I don't even care. I just want you to consistently do well over the long term if you're a money manager or if you're an investor. And that's my goal for you. Don't worry about the market. In fact, I wish I could find this quote. I can't find it, but I heard Warren Buffett say it. Forget about the market, forget about the indices, and go out and buy a company. I wish I could find it, the exact quote, because I'm not quoting him exactly, and that's why I don't put it down on paper, because I don't remember exactly what he said. But he basically just said, forget about what's going on in the market, and forget about trying to beat the market, and forget about the indices and everything. Just go out and buy a company. You like Nike? Go out and buy Nike. But do your homework first. And as we said, after you've done that homework, what do? Throw it away and ask yourself, do I really want to buy Nike? I'm not saying you should buy Nike, but I'm just using that as an example. Slide number 15. Now, let's get into some silliness. Because, folks, there's a lot of silliness in the world, of investing. Timing theories, the Monday effect, which Monday's the best day to buy, or is it the best day to sell? I can't remember. The January effect, as goes January, so goes the year. Well, people are just concentrating on January. You could do the same for all the other months and find out that because the market goes up 2 to 3 times more than it goes down, it's always the case, you know, that any month goes well, the rest of the month will go well. The Santa Claus rally, for some reason, they always believe there's a Santa Claus rally, or sometimes called the turn of the year effect. But, of course, if it fails in December, if the market goes down, they say, oh, it's tax selling. They don't know. They're just guessing. You know, they can't go interview every individual person who bought and sold. And now you hear this one, sell in May and go away. Well, the truth is, folks, statistically, over the long term, the best months are November to March, and the worst are September to October. But over the long term, it's a tiny difference. If you tried to trade on these pieces of information, it would just be worthless. It would just not work over the long term. Maybe you could get it to work, go ahead. But the idea that sell in May and go away because the best months of the year are past, and now you wait through the summer and through the fall and then start again in November to March, I don't agree. The Super Bowl theory. Now, this one's really strange. If the National League wins, that's bullish. And the American League wins, that's bearish. And you know what? It works. Or at least it has in the past. And you think, what is going on? And every year they trot out the discussion of who's going to win the Super Bowl and what's it going to mean for the stock market. And have you ever heard of coincidence? If you go through all the millions of things that are happening at one time, there's just going to be one that or two that are going to coincide with one another. For example, you might have heard, maybe you didn't, that the Pink Floyd Dark Side of the Moon album is perfectly coincided with the Wizard of Oz. If you start playing the Dark Side of the Moon with the Wizard of Oz, maybe it's a different movie, a different album, but the scenes change at the same time. And when they asked, because the Pink Floyd's album came out after the Wizard of Oz, obviously 30 years or 40 years after, and they asked the people who did the Pink Floyd, the group, and Alan Parsons, who was the producer, did you do this on purpose? They said, what are you, crazy? No, we didn't. We didn't think at all about the Wizard of Oz. It was just a coincidence. Hemlines. You see, miniskirts. When the hemlines of skirts went up in the 1920s and the 1960s, so did the stock market. And then when long skirts in the 1930s and 1970s became more popular, the stock market went down. You can't make this stuff up, folks. And there are many other silly theories, such as the lipstick indicator, the Boston snow indicator, which is also called the BS indicator. It's cute. The hot waitress indicator and the aspirin count theory. Look them up, folks. People really do spend time and energy on this stuff. And how about politics? Well, wait a minute. Poly means many, and ticks are blood-sucking insects, right? It's a joke. But which party, Republicans or demagogues, Republirats or demagogues, is better for the markets? Well, many people would say it's the Republicans, but it's not. You go back in time, and it turns out the Democratic administrations have been better for the stock market. But some of that is just dumb luck. In the 1920s, it was Herbert Hoover who was trashed by the crash of 1929. And then, of course, FDR comes in 1933, just at the bottom. And the same thing happened with Nixon in 72 and 73. And then, exactly, he got crashed by the stock market after it had done well in the 1960s under Kennedy and Johnson. In the 1980s, both Reagan got hit by 87, and then Bush got hit by a little nasty downturn when the Gulf War, just before the Gulf War started. But then Clinton, after the recession of 91-92, he just came in just at the right time when the internet started to explode and telecommunications started to explode, and he got out right before. You see, he was just, well, he didn't have anything to do with it. That's how the cycle ended. And he got out, and then George Bush the younger got hammered by the 2000 to 2002 and then the 2008 stock market crash. And Obama, the most hated president by the Republicans and the right wingers, they you could see the hatred dripping from their mouths. He's been the best president ever for the stock market. Folks, fact is always stranger than fiction. Slide number 16, All Stars of Investing. Now, you're going to read one up on Wall Street, right? Yeah, Peter Lynch. Brilliant guy, very down to earth, very readable. It is one of the most fun books you'll ever read because he's got a great sense of humor, self-deprecating. You know what that means? Kind of like me, makes fun of himself. But don't you make fun of him. He knew what he knew, and he did very well. And he said, don't buy companies you don't understand. Buy what you know. If you use FedEx and UPS because you go online all the time and buy stuff, then maybe you want to invest in FedEx. Doesn't mean you should, but you should. That's a place to start. Don't invest in some company that's doing something fabulous, fantastic with nanotechnology, biotechnology, wearables, and marijuana at the same time when you don't know anything about them. Warren Buffett said, oh, he says lots of good things, but he says, don't buy stock, buy a company, right? Forget about the stock, look at the company. He puts emphasis on the value of the entire company. He says, he recommends, look, if you would want to buy an entire company, and I'm just trying to think of good companies that you may like, but I don't know what companies you like, but say you wanted to buy an entire company, if you had the money to go out and buy it, great. Buy 10 shares, if you can afford 10 shares or whatever, how you can afford. See, he likes companies like Coca-Cola and McDonald's and Procter & Gamble, Gillette, and the like. He likes companies that people buy their stuff every day. Benjamin Graham was Warren Buffett's teacher, and he wrote The Intelligent Investor, which is a book you eventually want to read. Folks, don't read it first. It's a little hard to penetrate, but make sure you get the ones that you will. You'll see them at the library, the newer editions, with Jason Zweig's commentary, because they're awesome. It's awesome. It's you will come away with a new appreciation of what it's like to be an investor. And then Sir John Templeton, one of the first mutual fund managers to invest globally. Pretty good for a kid from Tennessee. And Bill Miller, slide 17. Bill Miller, fund manager of the Legg Mason Value Trust that we saw back in Chapter 4 and how it had done so well and crashed and burned. For 15 calendar years in a row, he beat the S&P 500. An unprecedented record. And he became, unfortunately for him, as far as I'm concerned, the financial media's megastar. 15 years in a row. It's kind of like, what's the guy? I can never remember. He's a baseball... He's Tony Gwynn. He's here in San Diego. He passed away, sadly, but he won the batting championship, I think, 7 times. Nobody's going to do that again. I don't know. Maybe somebody will. But then what happens? He started to lag, and then he did really badly in 2007 and 8. I mean, he just crashed. He seemed to start to redeem himself in 2009, but then trailed again badly in 2010 and 11, and they finally let him retire in 2012, and then changed the name of the mutual fund. It's a rough business, dear students, a very rough business. And people would say to me, well, why don't you invest with Miller? And I would say to them, you know, I appreciate him, I admire him very much, but he's too concentrated. He would keep about 40, 45 stocks in his mutual fund, which is, you know, we buy a mutual fund for diversification. So it was great when those stocks were doing well, but it's a two-edged sword. It really did poorly when they did poorly. Say, yeah, that's not good. So slide number 19. What do all these people have in common? They have courage to not follow the crowd because the conventional wisdom, in my humble opinion, and history bears it out, is usually not very wise. When everybody's doing one thing, it usually means that's the wrong thing to do. And that's the reason why I think index funds are not necessarily the best way to go, because everyone says they're the best way to go. An eye for unrecognized value. What does that mean? Well, they have a sixth sense. They see something that everybody else doesn't see. And, you know, it's just not something you can necessarily train somebody to do. And I like to use the example of Walmart. Any idiot can buy Walmart now that it's the world's largest retailer. The trick was to buy it 30, 40 years ago. When who was the world's largest retailer? Kmart. You young folks don't believe that, do you? No. And what did Walmart do? They started in the rural areas, building these huge shopping places, Walmarts, in Bentonville, Arkansas, or St. George, Utah. And the JCPenney's and the Sears, and they just said, what are these people doing? You know, just 5,000 people live in St. George, not anymore. St. George, Utah has gotten big, but what? Well, the guy who started Walmart, Sam Wall, knew that people in the rurals, because he was from a rural town, a small town, USA, they thought nothing of driving 2 hours to go shopping. So he knew he was going to attract people from all over, and he did. And then it was only a matter of time before they, right, exactly went to the urban areas. So all us urbanites are looking at these people thinking, what are they doing? But the people who said, oh, no, you don't understand. That guy's a genius. They're the ones that bought Walmart. I didn't buy Walmart 30 years ago. Anyway, Garry Kasparov and Anatoly Karpov, who are they? Well, unless you know the world of chess, you wouldn't know that they were the two best chess players in the world in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And one would win, and then next year the other would win. It was a real knockdown drag out, as much as chess can be a knockdown drag out. And he was once asked why he and Anatoly Karpov were the two best chess players in the world. And his answer was astonishingly simple and direct. We attack better than anybody else, and we defend better than anybody else. Yeah. Can you throw a fastball at 95 miles an hour? Can you hit that fastball? These people, these all-stars of investing, bought the best companies, and they avoided the worst companies. And speaking of avoidance, as a mutual fund investor, which I mostly am, I am, in terms of stocks, I am not looking to find the next Peter Lynch or the next Bill Miller or the next Warren Buffett. No. What I'm trying to do is avoid the next Charles Stedman. Charles Stedman ran his own mutual fund, the Stedman American Industry Fund, from December 1959 until his death in late 1997. And his cumulative total return during the largest increase in the global economy in the history of the world was a minus 42.9%. He would have done much better simply placing his investors' funds into a savings account at a bank or putting it under a mattress. I don't know, maybe you came from the life insurance industry. Yeah. So you see, avoid the Charles Stedmans. Go look for the next Peter Lynch, fine, good luck. But look for people who are solid and have done well over the long term, and avoid the next Charles Stedman. Slide number 20. Warren Buffett says, be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful. Fear and greed, fear and greed. Everybody's running that way, you run the other way. And his mentor, Benjamin Graham, said it this way. Buy when most people, including the experts, are overly pessimistic, and sell when they are actively optimistic. It's not easy to do, folks. We're hardwired. We're humans. We see a bunch of people running one way. What do? We run with them. Because 100,000 years ago, the people who didn't run, who stood there and said, look at all those people running, they're the ones that got eaten by the tigers. So it's in our genes. But in the financial world, it can be deadly. Slide number 21. John Templeton, Sir John Templeton, says that bear markets are born of pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. But it's also the hardest, right? Who wants to buy when everybody else is saying the world's going to end? On a similar note, he also said to buy when others are despondently selling and sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest reward. Now, did Sir John Templeton follow his own advice? You better believe he did. It's January 1941, and Europe has torn itself apart. And what's going to happen? Right, the United States is going to be dragged into World War II when the Japanese attacked the Third Fleet in the Hawaiian Islands. Totally surprised? Well, no, many people thought or believed or accused the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration of pushing the Japanese into war as a way to get into the war, because the Americans, they were dragged into World War I under false pretenses, and they didn't want to do that again. And Roosevelt and his administration saw what the Nazis were doing and said, we got to help these people. But it was very difficult for him. So people believe, and there are historians who will argue this. We're never going to know. They'll argue that we pushed the Japanese into war. Be that as it may, we're in trouble because they probably thought they're going to attack the Philippines or maybe Alaska. They went right into the heart of the Third Fleet and it knocked out one third of the fleet in one day. And what did Sir John Templeton do? He called up his broker and I said, said to the broker, I want you to buy every bankrupt company on the New York Stock Exchange. Right. Can you imagine the broker's reaction? What? 4 years later, Sir John Templeton, he wasn't a knight yet, but John Templeton was a very wealthy man. The war was over. Would you have that kind of courage? I don't think I would. I don't think I'd sell. I didn't sell in 2000 to 2002, nor did I sell in 2008, but it wasn't fun. I did put in some more money in during those times, a little bit more than I normally put in, but mostly I just continued to put in my 403B and Roth IRA contributions as I did, you know, for many years. But then put a little bit more in. But I'm not trying to claim I'm anything like Sir John Templeton. I didn't call up the broker and said, buy every bankrupt stock. Slide 22. Famous myths and stupid sayings. Let's go through these. And I got these from various places, but mostly I got them from Mr. Lynch, thank you. It can't go any lower. Oh, yes, it can. When can it not go lower? When it hits zero. That's when it can't go any lower. It can't go any hot. Wait a minute. Oh, yes, it can. If the earnings are continuing to grow, there's no limit to how high the price would go. And this is, people would say this about Procter & Gamble and Philip Morris and other of the stalwarts that have been around for decades. It can't go any higher. Yeah, well, if they keep increasing their market share, moving into new markets, coming out with new products, sure, it can go higher. It's only $3 a share. It's only 25 cents a share. It's only 5 cents a share. What can I lose? You can lose it all. It doesn't matter how low the price is. The price can go to zero, and you can lose all your money. Remember, the price is irrelevant. Look at the market capitalization. Look at the valuation. It has to come back. Oh, have you ever heard of Penn Central? You've heard of Penn Station under Madison Square Garden in New York. That was part of Penn Central. The world's largest railroad company, been around for over 150 years, went bankrupt and has never been heard from again. How about Kodak? Remember Polaroid? Slide number 23. It's always darkest before the dawn. Well, sometimes it's always darkest before it's pitch black. When it rebounds to 10 bucks, I know what they're saying here. I know what they're saying. They bought it at $10. Now it's 6. They want it to go back to 10 so they can say, I bought it at 10 and didn't lose. We're hardwired not to accept losses. But if you would not buy it now at $6, sell it. You know, accept that you're going to make mistakes. But if you would buy it at $6, go right ahead. Do your research and say, hey, the future's still bright. But if you stubbornly hang on to a stock just because you don't want to admit you made a mistake, you're making a grave error that we'll discuss in more detail in the next chapter. If it goes down 10%, sell. This is what the traders and speculators do. They put these stops on the stock so they don't lose too much. But you're guaranteed then a loss. Even blue chip companies fluctuate greatly. So if you sold each stock that lost 10%, you would almost always sell your winners along with your losers. So I don't like this. But other people say, no, you're protecting against a loss. Well, I say what you're doing is you're guaranteeing a loss. If you still believe in the company, so it goes down 10%, it's taking too long. Well, patience is an investor's most important trait. In my humble opinion, it will take a long time. Unless you're lucky or just really darn good, folks, it's going to take a long time. Great. Gives you plenty of time to buy more. Slide 24. Look at all the money I lost. I didn't buy it. Huh? Coulda, woulda, shoulda, folks. You did not lose a cent by not buying a stock that will do well. Don't fret over it. I missed that one. I'll catch the next one. Well, the next one rarely makes it. When's the next Microsoft going to come around? It's not. You know, it's going to be some other technology. When's the next Google coming around? Well, some people are saying Facebook is going to eclipse Google. I don't know. But if you're interested in a company that has a great search engine, who are you going to buy? Yahoo? I don't know. The stock has gone up. I must be a genius. Well, there's a saying that says, never mistake a bull market for brains. In fact, long-time money managers and investors will tell you that it was great that they started in the middle of a bear market. It was great. It gave them humility. And others will tell you, oh, I started right at the beginning of a bull market, and after a few years, I thought I was invincible. What a bad deal that was. Yeah, right. Humility, dear students, humility. The stock's gone down. I must be an idiot. No, no. You might do all the good research and pick a good stock with good prospects, and for some reason, totally unrelated to your research and the companies, it could go down severely depending on technology or whatever, so don't beat yourself up. You're going to make mistakes, that's for sure. Slide 25. It's different this time. Well, technically, yes, it's different every time, folks, but that doesn't mean you should pay an astronomical price for a company that probably will never make a dollar's worth of profit, the internet stocks of the 1990s. It's a new era! When you hear this, doesn't matter if it's real estate or stocks or Beanie Babies or whatever, run. It's a permanent I like that one. That's from, what's his name? That's not from Peter Lynch, that's from, it'll come to me in a while, but he's been a financial writer for many years, and I love that. A permanent trend, ain't no such thing. He wrote the only investment book you'll ever need, and he's a great writer. I can't remember his name now. I'm sorry. Begins with an A. Anyway, stocks are too risky! No. Even with all the shenanigans and stupidity, folks, they are still the best long-term financial investment. But you have to acknowledge people's fears, because they will be frightened, as you will be. There are going to be times when you're just frightened. And you have to remember that there are shenanigans, there is stupidity, but they are still the best long-term investment. And I firmly believe the next 20, 30 years, the world is going to change in marvelous ways. I mean, we're not even going to recognize it. Think 20 years ago, the internet was out there, but it hadn't exploded on the world yet. Netscape had not come public yet, just became public 20 years ago. And so, think about the next 20 years, what's going to happen. Assuming we don't blow ourselves up, which is always a distinct possibility, Putin scares living daylights out of me, Ebola doesn't become a rage, meteorite, earthquake, disco returns. 70s were tough, folks. Most of you weren't around for that, but disco was tough. But I firmly believe that things are going to get great. Come back in 10, 20 years. I might be dead by that time. Slide 26. And that, dear students, is our discussion of stock price behavior and market efficiency. And what we're going to do next is introduce even more silliness when we discuss behavioral finance and the psychology of investing. So welcome to the end of Chapter 17. As I said, we've done our heavy lifting with chapters 5, 6, and 7, 17, 5, 6, and 17. Chapter 7 was a little bit of silliness, some good stuff about the all-stars of investing. We'll wait to get to chapter 8. It's all blech as far as I'm concerned, technical analysis. And just wait, folks, I'm going to get that guy's name, Andrew, I'm going to pause, hang on a minute. Aha, Andrew Tobias, I'm sorry. His name is Andrew Tobias. I'm sorry, Mr. Tobias, I like your work. He wrote the only investment guide you'll ever need. And, he's being a little tongue-in-cheek, but he wrote many other books, too. And he's really fun to listen to. He's very erudite, very sharp. And he's the one who said, beware the permanent trend, because there ain't no such thing. A trend is temporary. Anyway, see you in chapter 8.